All right, call to celebration. As a Sufi, I begin us in the Sufi way by beginning with the cry of Allahu Akbar, which is not a war cry. It's a cry of radical inclusiveness. Allah, the unity, Akbar, is greater than. The unity is greater than what you had for breakfast, what mood you are in right now, what mood the person sitting next to you is in right now, your plans for your garden this afternoon, the many, many worlds that you inhabit, the many, many conversations going on inside. Allahu Akbar, the unity is greater than. You name it, the unity is greater than, which means that you need leave nothing behind to be here now. The Fatiha, which is an opening prayer, the name Fatiha means the opening, is a prayer of opening all the worlds that we are into all the worlds that there are. It's in Arabic, one of several sacred languages, which means that the meaning comes through the sounds as much as through any translation. Translation essentially means, in the name of the unity, merciful and compassionate, please help me to live in such a way that I am walking the straight path and not one of those who goes astray. But really listen with your bodies for the vibration as it comes through. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen.
Ah.
closer to the flaming chalice, which is the subject of the guided meditation. The flaming chalice is, among other things, a fitting symbol for the radical inclusiveness of the open heart. Like the unshielded flame spreading light and warmth without distinction in all directions, the open heart is the center of a territory that knows no boundaries. What is the heart? How do we find the heart beyond idea and with experience? I want to invite you to put a hand in the center of your chest. There's a whole area that I'm calling heart, that place where love is felt, that place where the sense of being loved is felt. And most importantly, that place which is like an open space of light, the flame on the inside. Sometimes it can take a moment or two to really drop down out of idea into what I call the jacuzzi within. Sometimes we say, oh, I'll stay up in my head and listen to what she has to say next. And that's not the same as actually dropping into that swirling place. Yeah, there we go. The room drops in. Good. Sometimes we'd rather not drop in, because when the awareness of the heart opens, there's the awareness of all sorts of things we haven't been aware of. Difficult feelings. Things that might even be wonderful, but we didn't have the time for. Let yourself feel all that there is in this jacuzzi at the chest. What makes it tolerable? What makes it worthwhile? What makes it sane and glorious is when we can drop into the jacuzzi of all that we feel in here and feel what's at the center, like a whirlpool in the midst of all that swirls within us that is very human. Finding the open space like a whirlpool in the middle. This is what I am calling heart. Something that is felt after I have dropped into my human experience fully. Those who are still more up in the head and the third eye looking down at your heart, see if you can draw. A good way to go is to use the word ah. Yes, exactly. Follow the leader. Try saying it first from your head. Just another word coming from your head. Ah. And then feeling the vibration as it comes right underneath your fingertips, as though your heart were a speaker vibrating, as though your mouth were right there in your heart. Try saying from the heart, ah. Once more, just so that we really feel the contrast, come back up into your merry little head and say, ah, from way up here. Ah, ah, feel different? And then come back home, drop into the jacuzzi, drop into the fullness, Allahu Akbar, the unity is greater. Drop into the ocean in your human body. And say, from the center place of the heart, ah, Thank you. Inclusiveness of the open heart, like the chalice flame, a poem by Edwin Markham, outwitted. They drew a circle that drew me out. Rebel, heretic, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that drew them in. I'm here today to talk about unity and conflict. It's a tough task. Just say the word unity and notice what happens here in your chest. You can feel with your hand and heart again, unity.
Unity.
Unity. Unity. What does that feel like? How is it there? Unity.
Conflict. 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 What do you notice? Any physiological shifts going on? Conflict.
Unity. Unity. Unity.
Conflict.
It's almost as though we are two different people when we are approaching a situation from unity, or when we are approaching a situation from
conflict.
Who was that unity person? Right, the unity person.
Conflict. Unity's out the window. What do you mean?
This huge gap of physiology and spirit. It's like a schizoid process. Unity and conflict. Who am I? Who might we be? Allahu Akbar. Unity includes everything, including conflict. How do we bring this together in ourselves so that we're not like some kind of hormonal seesaw between worlds? I began with the Fatiha because what we're wanting to do is open all the worlds. Open all the worlds so that we can know unity that's not necessarily free of conflict. But to move through conflict in such a way that we don't have conflict, such that unity is not lost in the process. This is a discipline. Probably best to start with baby steps, just because when we talk about conflict, things get really heavy, really fast. We think about ways that lives are ruined. We think about wars. We think about all sorts of things that are so strong inside of us that we lose our unity physiology, and the conversation is already over in a way. So I want to start with some baby steps and not speak at first about those really difficult situations, but begin a little more 101 with, for instance, situations probably all of us have been in where we're pretty clear about something. And it's something that we really actually know our stuff about. We know what we're talking about, and we can't get it across to the person we're talking to. And the problem here is that the other person is not open-minded enough to get what we are saying because they've got what they already think. They already think that. And they think what they think, and that's the end of the conversation. And it's like you're talking to a busy signal you can't get through. The busy signal is already inside of them and is making it so that even though you know something here, right? We know these types of situations. We've probably all been in them where you've tried to communicate. Can't blame me. I tried to communicate. I tried to get this through. It was not getting through. Communication is not happening here, so I'm not trying to communicate anymore. I'm trying to maneuver around the person. At best, we avoid discussing it further. At worst, we hire an attorney, right? But getting across to them, helping them, they don't get it. They don't get it. The only thing even more difficult, like the next step up from that is when they think that we're the one doesn't get it. They are pretty sure that they know their stuff and they're perfectly clear, and they think that we don't get what they're saying to us, but we get it. We get it. We get it. We've already thought it through and we already know that that doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. So they don't get it that we do get it, and they're still thinking that we don't get it. And they start talking to us in that tone of voice that is absolutely infuriating to children and creates instant rebellion and is even worse for grown-ups, of sounding incredibly calm and incredibly reasonable with that, "of course I'm right," tone of voice. And there they are talking to us in this manner that, frankly, it's completely obnoxious. I'm right. If you were as calm and rational and thorough a thinker as I am, it would be so clear to you that I'm right. And I'm not going to come out and say to you, "I'm right," but listen to how I talk. This is how people who are right talk. It should therefore be obvious that I'm right. I'm being subtle about it. But from my voice and my body language, even if I can't get through to you with my ideas, it should be apparent to you that it's very clear that I'm right. And wouldn't it be great if these people who know that they're right, or think that they're right and that we don't get it, could hear how they sound when they're so sure that they're absolutely right? Because when they're talking to us like that, I mean, it's demeaning. If they're right, what does that say about us? That we're wrong? Forget it. End of conversation. Possibly beginning of shouting match. But definitely end of conversation. At this point, we've been talking about other people. There may be some other people, of those other people that you wish were here right now, hearing about how obnoxious it is to sound as though you are completely reasonable.
and subtly or not so subtly cueing others that you're clear that you're right. But it's also time to take a thorough moral inventory of the ways and times in which we are right. But wait, I hear your soul cry. What about the times when I really am right? Okay, but think about that tone of voice and that body language that unconsciously but immediately begins to come across. And you may validly substitute in any sentence in which you would use the word right, you may validly substitute the word obnoxious. But what about when I am right? But what about when I am obnoxious? Yeah. Sufi peacemakers say, you can be right or you can be love. You can be right or you can be love. What does it mean to drop being right, to drop being separate, to drop being superior, to drop everything that stands in the way of coming into communion of truth? One of the things it takes is to drop into the heart, where communion of truth takes place. The doorway to communion of truth is love. What do I mean by love and heart? By love, I don't mean a soppy Valentine sentimentality. By heart, I don't mean a welter of neurotic emotion. By heart, I mean the whirlpool, the space, the radically inclusive flaming chalice in the midst of all those emotions, right at the center. By love, well, to speak of what is meant by love, perhaps we start with a slightly simpler term, one of the prerequisites for love, which is politeness, or in Arabic, adab. Adab is translated as politeness, but it's not just please and thank you. Adab. Adab is feeling in my own heart the place of radically inclusive light, the stillness in the midst of the emotions, the chalice, the flame in here. I may be feeling all kinds of things, but a radiant void is at the center of all that. The Sufis say that the heart is the throne of the All-Merciful, the place of the divine within us. Am I in that place in myself? That's the first step in adab, politeness. Have I lost it? Am I swimming in emotionalism? It's fine to have emotions. But have I lost the center? That's step one for adab, finding that place in me, radiant void, chalice of light. And the second step in adab is addressing that place in others, orienting towards that place in others. In the stranger that I meet, though I may not have seen outward evidence of it yet, adab means greeting that stranger knowing that inside here, in the midst of everything else going on inside of them, is a flaming chalice, is a world full of openness filled with light. That is politeness. It means in the conversation with the beloved who isn't seeming all that beloved at the moment, being with and being from this place in myself and acknowledging that that same place is inside the other person, and addressing that place in the other person. Does that change your choice of words? Yes, probably. But the politeness of word choice is a secondary effect of the true adab, the true politeness, which is coming from this divine throne, this flaming chalice, addressing it on faith sometimes in the other. This has potentially immediate effect. Certainly it is the case that if what you are talking to, if whom you are addressing is an insufferable jerk, then probably an insufferable jerk will reply. If who you are addressing is an unreasonable, unmentionable word, then that is probably who will reply. If who you are addressing is a sovereign sanity that is in the midst of the swirl of all human experience, dwelling in the other person's chest, there are two places where an effect might show up. One is in the other person, potentially. Sometimes there's a shift right away. When we are polite with the other person, they hear us differently. The second place that it shows up is right here, in our own chest. We are holding fast to our own covenant of politeness. And there's a satisfaction in that which radiates very differently than the potential poison that enters our own system when we're addressing an unreasonable, unmentionable. It is certainly the case that peacemaking takes time and that our first conversation with someone may well need to be a unilateral example of adab, of politeness. They may pick up on it right away. Try it. There are many situations where there's some sort of tone shift right away. And there are other situations where it's not going to be an immediate shift. There's a momentum of emotion already in progress in the other person that they have not been able to step into that whirlpool, that void of light, right away. Okay. War is quick. Peacemaking takes time. And, in fact, in Sufi peacemaking, you always want to set it up so that there's not one grand confrontation to resolve everything. You want short, mediated episodes of working things out. Because in peacemaking through the adab, one of the most important moments is what happens when you're sure that you're right, but you said, okay, never mind being right, I'm here to be loved as the doorway to a communion of truth between us. And the other person does a little dance all over your face and says, screw you, da 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 da, back, back. Okay, this actually is the significant peacemaking moment. Can I remain in the adab with someone who is not in the adab with me? That's more than just a difficult personal spiritual discipline. That earns an extraordinary amount of respect. It takes people by surprise. They don't expect it. They expect you to lash back from your emotions and not to remain in the place of radical inclusiveness. They expect that something will come back that is retaliatory. They expect, basically, that you will shut. And when we don't, when we say, ouch, I'm not happy about the decision you just made. I'm not happy about what you did. I'm remaining right here, seeking communion of truth. a flaming chalice, addressing a flaming chalice, I know you're in there. I may not have heard from you recently, but in every conversation between us, I am going to hold the faith that there is a place of meeting that is sane and inclusive of all light, the territory with no boundaries. It's not easy. It takes practice. It also takes a moral inventory of our sense of pleasure. Because pleasure and what we take pleasure in and where we take pleasure really is the key to maintaining adab when someone else steps on us. It's really the heart of what it means to be a good loser, which is why it's better to set things up as a series of conversations rather than one big confrontation, so that I can show you, okay, in my time of loss, in my time of thwartedness, this is what politeness looks like. But in order to do that, I need to look very, very carefully at whether I more greatly enjoy a moment of defeat, offsetting my pain with the pleasure of hatred. Because don't kid yourself, it's a pleasure, it feels good. Even the most peace-loving and wonderful spiritual among us has got to contend with the fact that it feels really good when someone hurts you to just hate them. To hate them! To use our feeling of powerlessness and not having any other redress to being able to take this loss and say, I'm going to get you back by hating you. Or by judging you. By saying you're a jerk. By writing you off. By essentially murdering you. In the heart. You are one person now. See how much power I have? Not the power to change your mind. Not the power to whatever it might be. But I can kill you, and I'm going to take pleasure in that. It's a silent murder for which we are not outwardly judged. But it's important to note that pleasure that we may take. Do we, in time of pain and loss, take pleasure in killing, judging, being superior, being right? Or do we take pleasure in our covenant of politeness, of being a seeker of communion of truth? To do this, it takes a heart that really truly is open, like the flaming chalice, 360, all the way around. It's not for nothing that the posture for prayer in so many cultures is a head bowed forward and shoulders slightly rounded, which opens the back of the heart. Sometimes between me and this world, it's difficult. I may not find my pleasure here. But can I feel what I am part of, Allahu Akbar, the unity that is greater than? The power of the flame, the pleasure of integrity, as a physiological as well as a spiritual state, a very different body on the inside. The body of the one who walks in prayer, even in time of conflict, and says, ah, that's how this last interaction went down. I will take pleasure in the state of my own heart. Because really, what have we got in life that can't be taken away except our own state, the nature of our own heart? I will stay with this, take pleasure in this, perhaps unseen outwardly, although honestly, as subtle as that message of I'm right is, i.e. not so subtle, this message also comes through in tone of voice, comes through in body language, and bespeaks to others, someone willing to both speak and listen, to make a unity that transcends conflict and over time moves us through. Amen. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas and language, even the phrase, each other, doesn't make any sense. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. Let us now rise and join together in hymn number 143.
Forever, thou the reign.
now extinguish the symbolic flame, which means now it's up to us to carry it in here. Let's join in the closing circle. In the Sufi way, we actually end also with the Fatiha, because every ending is a new beginning. We most especially do it when something has happened that has in some way created a change for the better. It's like a way of pressing control save on the universe to say, okay, let's begin again, but from here. So, going forth, Allahu Akbar. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ir-Rahmanir Rahim. Maliki نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا صراطا مستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم